Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, you're with the show. There we go. Good morning, you are with the show Three Women, Three Ways, and we are the radio program that looks at things in the news. We look at events that are happening. We look at trends. We look at just about anything that catches our interest, and we tend to have a focus on interpersonal relationships, especially violence against women, and just kind of the general state of things. Today, I'm Heather Stark, and I am here in the studio with Linda Olson. And Linda is a really special guest for us today because she has just a great deal of knowledge about a project called Housing First. And one of the things that I would like to tell about Linda is that I've known her for a number of years. She has always worked very diligently in the field of domestic violence, and she has a wealth of knowledge about this topic. What we're going to talk about it today, of course, is her project. And Linda, could you just tell us about yourself a little bit before we get started?
Hi, Heather. It is just such a pleasure to be here with you. And as Heather mentioned, we've known each other for a number of years. I've worked for close to 30 years in the field of domestic violence, primarily in shelter and housing programs. And most recently, I'm at the Washington State Coalition Against Domestic Violence as their housing project coordinator, which is a relatively new position. And it's been fun and exciting. I love to try new projects, and I love to see how we can all better respond to those who have experienced and been victimized by domestic violence.
Yes, because it's not just a one-shot deal, is it? It tends to linger and stay for sometimes years with people who've been victimized, and it can be a pretty tough thing. Well, in the past, and I don't like to talk about my own personal experience too much on the air, but I certainly have known a lot of women who did not go to a shelter. In the past, if you were experiencing domestic violence and you wanted out, your lawyer, the police, probably a number of friends and relatives would say, just leave. Just leave. Get out of that house. Get out of that apartment. Leave him. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that they never seem to follow through on is, where do you go when you leave him? Mm-hmm. And years ago, we're talking 30 years ago, 35 years ago, women who had to leave would kind of have a little contact with almost an underground network where individual women would open their houses to a woman who needed shelter. But that can be risky for the person who's doing it. And so that quickly segued into housing, specialized housing, called shelters, someplace they could go to get shelter. But a lot of glitches in that, and I know I've toured a lot of housing shelters for domestic violence victims, and they're pretty grim in my experience. You're living with a bunch of other people, you have to turn in any medications just as if you were in a school environment. It kind of takes away your independence, I think, and it also, at least, you know, back in the day, you couldn't take an adult son or a teenage son with you. You know, they didn't want, they would have to go to a different shelter. So my experience and what I've known about DV shelters, Linda, has been pretty grim. Am I wrong about that?
No, I don't think you're wrong at all, Heather. And while the idea of a communal living shelter worked some 20, 30 years ago as we were starting up this whole movement as a place for women to go because there weren't necessarily laws that might protect them. Protection orders hadn't come into existence yet. There wasn't necessarily the acknowledgement that divorce might be a necessity for some relationships. So there were many reasons that women might choose to try and get away in that way, and the communal living environment was intended to break the isolation of domestic violence that they might have often experienced in a home that was trying to be controlling and very abusive. So that has been where our movement started and did save many, many lives along the way. But you are so right. Whenever people live together, often rules spring up. it's hard to enter an environment where 8 or 9 or 10 other households are all in crisis. And as we're finding out more and more about trauma and how that impacts people, the idea of, again, that many families with their children so impacted by trauma, trying to live together, and shelter advocates trying to regulate and monitor the environment, it's challenging. So we've very recently been looking at the housing homeless world, which has started developing, and actually for many years now, with the chronically homeless population and now the families population, a concept that housing is a right. And that rather than building this homeless response system of emergency shelter, transitional housing, we should really try to develop ways to support people accessing housing much more quickly, particularly for their stability and the stability of children. And so
you just mentioned that, you know, this is kind of tied in with the homeless sheltering issue.
Uh-huh.
There are, am I right that a large percentage of the homeless people are women who have left violent situations?
Absolutely correct. There are numbers that go from about 50 to 80% of women with children are homeless because of domestic violence. Or rather, homeless women are homeless because of domestic violence.
Sure, yeah.
So it is a huge population because the domestic violence emergency shelter system could not accommodate the many survivors who were losing their housing either because of safety or because of the economic reasons. Sometimes their income was radically impacted by separating from a partner or trying to maintain employment when you're being harassed and often losing employment because of that harassment. So,
divorce always impacts, has a financial impact under the best of circumstances. So, to throw in the violence and in many cases fear for safety, fear for life and limb, and, the economic thing, I think, has to be one of the worst things for women who are going through this. And a lot of times, women don't, they might leave or their abuser might be arrested or whatever, and then they don't want to press charges or they don't want the abuser put in jail. And sometimes people interpret that as some sort of personality flaw on the part of the victim, but don't you think it has more to do with a lot of economic stuff? I mean, safety stuff, too, but a lot of economic stuff. If you've got some kids and he is part of the breadwinner, isn't that a big consideration?
Of course. You're so right. There are so many reasons why a woman would choose to return to or to stay in a relationship that's related to economics. It could be related to culture or religion or fear. The greatest danger level for a woman is when she chooses to end that relationship. So the fear, the need for children to have a father and wanting to make sure that the family is as intact and her own responsibility in trying to do that, instead of asking, well, why don't we just look at the choice to use violence and address that a little more actively. But yes, many, many women want the violence to stop and they don't want to end a relationship or break up a family.
Yeah, it's tough. And I think in our culture we also talk a lot about fatherhood and how important a father is to children. And I don't debate that, except I would put an exception on it. And that is, a bad father, I don't think, is necessarily an asset to raising children.
No.
So if you have an abusive father, that's a bad father, in my opinion. And you've got women who are thinking, well, the pressure is that my children need their father. And so that adds even more pressure. Linda, I want to throw out our phone number for our listeners. We have a call-in line, and we'd love for you to join us. If you've had experience in shelters especially, let us know about that. And we also have a chat room that you can access. And the phone number is 646-378-0430. That's 646-378-0430. 1-800-530. Call us if you have any questions or want to share an experience that you have had in trying to find shelter or housing in a violent situation. So, Linda, when was the thinking changed that these shelters were not such a great idea, that we needed to come up with something better?
Well, as I mentioned, the housing first sort of movement was getting a lot of attention, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, some 4+5 years ago, started looking at that and realizing that some of the hardest people to house in traditional transitional housing programs tended to be survivors of domestic violence. And there was one amazing program in Portland, Oregon, called Home Free, that was operated by the Volunteers of America, where they sold their shelter 10 years ago, and just started doing rapid rehousing, housing first strategies. And for that emergency response, would use motel vouchers or other Portland area shelters. And the Gates Foundation was quite intrigued with this, so put the invitation out to the Washington State Coalition Against Domestic Violence to coordinate a pilot project in Washington State. So we started with 4 agencies in 2009, and it went so well. It was such an amazing response, tailored for the individual needs of women, and the agencies were encouraged to be creative and think about different ways that women could both access housing as well as stay in their own housing. Because the initial assumption was, of course, women needed to leave. But, you know, when we think of protection orders and we think of women who might be stable in their own homes, why destabilize that if they think they can stay in their communities safely with just a little bit of security assistance financially, or perhaps some rental assistance or mortgage payment assistance? So that has just really skyrocketed, and we've added another 9 agencies to the additional cohort of 4 agencies, and there are other programs across the state that are not currently Gates funded to do it that are trying the same sort of initiatives to support survivors, and are pretty pleased with the results. And of course, there are struggles and barriers, and it's not always easy in smaller communities where housing is really lacking, or our urban communities where affordable housing is challenging. But even then, it has been gratifying to listen to survivors, women, male survivors of domestic violence, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered survivors of domestic violence, and survivors in culturally specific communities say this is so much better than struggling in a community living shelter if we can figure out other temporary sources of housing that's more private, and then get into our own homes much more quickly. So,
I read an article this week about Cambridge, Massachusetts. The housing authority there says that they're going to put aside 2 public housing units for clients of Transition House. So, in other words, Transition House is kind of a shelter for women, and they're going to set aside 2 public housing units as part of the domestic violence program. And that sounds like, you know, substantial housing. How, you know, is this a good idea? How is this different from what you're working on, Linda?
As I recall from that article, the idea of those 2 units was to provide a year's experience in being in permanent housing that would be required before those survivors could actually either live in that housing or another unit permanently. And I think what's different in this project, including many of our own relationships in Washington State with housing authorities, is that units are put to one side, and there is certainly the option to stay in that unit and support is transitional. Rental assistance might also be temporary, but there isn't this notion that survivors have to be in a temporary situation for a certain period of time before they can earn their housing. And I think that's just that little bit of catch there. You know, we all have to learn what to do in terms of being good tenants and paying our rent, and survivors are no different from anyone else, including those who have never had that experience of doing so independently. But with a fairly minimal amount of support, they really can quite adequately be good tenants and maintain that housing. And sometimes the domestic advocacy is critical in that, and sometimes there's other community supportive services that they need in order to retain and maintain their housing. But it shouldn't necessarily be a carrot at the end of a program that requires certain program components and good behavior.
Yeah. Again, from my knowledge of domestic violence, which spans about 13 years now, there are so many issues. There are so many things that a woman has to go through. And I say woman because the vast majority of abuse is men abusing women. And there's so many things that she has to consider when she mm-hmm. has to leave or wants to leave. And one of them is money. One of them is schools for her kids. One of them is stability for her kids. One of them is, you know, like you were saying, how come she and the kids have to leave their environment? And can they afford to stay there? All of these issues. And am I going to open the door and find him there as a safety issue? Just all of these things. And then you have to also think about housing. Where am I going to live? If I can't live here and I can't afford this, then it means more chaos for my children. It means more chaos for me. You know, how important is housing for a woman going through domestic violence issues?
What we're seeing from this particular project, as well as just hearing from survivors as they negotiate emergency shelter and transitional housing programs, that it is so critical for the stability of their lives. It's hard to figure out where you're going to work if you don't know where you're going to live. It's hard to really get children stabilized in schools, and we know now that children lose ground the more frequently they are moved from school to school. And just some of the components and the tensions of not having a stable living environment propel someone more into a survival mode versus that place where trauma can be healed, where they can work on other things like their legal issues, mental health, stability, and the education for the children, that tends to take place more after someone has found that stable place to live versus trying to determine from day to day where are they going to be next. Oh, dear, the emergency shelter stay is up in 30 days. Where am I going to go? The transitional housing stay is up in 12 months. What will happen after that? Will I just get stabilized in this particular place with my children happy in school, only needing to uproot and leave again? So trying to eliminate some of those initial moves so that somebody can really focus on the rest of their lives. And that those are the types of quotes we see from survivors so frequently, is that I can look at the rest of my life now. I can finally settle in with my children, and they are so much happier. Or I can choose my community, and I know my neighbors. The police department is close by. I feel that people have my back. I feel safer. So those are the kinds of things that we're hearing from survivors who have participated in this particular project.
Mm-hmm. So how long has this project been going on?
It has been going on now for almost 5 years, and we've got another year to go, so we're pretty excited about that.
Yeah. When you say you have another year to go, you mean you have another year of funding?
Another year of funding. And, of course, a part of that funding is supporting each agency with sustainability of this particular project. And each of the 13 agencies are doing some fascinating things to make the program sustainable in terms of changing their agency culture related to shelter and to housing. And,
okay, now you're talking program director talk. Let's talk. When you're talking about sustainability and all of that. But basically what you're saying is you're trying to figure out a way that you can pay for it after the funding runs out. Is that right?
Right. Instead of this being a separate standalone project that when the funding goes, the project goes, trying to figure out ways that with existing funds, this approach can become a part of how domestic violence agencies do business.
Okay. So if I need to leave a domestic violence situation, or say I'm in a marriage with a couple of kids and my husband is arrested for domestic violence and told he has to leave the house, and I have a little house in the suburbs, but my income is minimal. You know, I work part-time, and I have, like, maybe $800 a month that's mine. And the court hasn't, ordered that he help pay with anything yet. What are my options? I mean, do I pack up and go to the shelter? If I contact, a shelter organization, what are they going to tell me to do? And we're talking Washington State right now, and hopefully this is going to be very similar to other states. But what do I do? Walk me through that process. I'm stunned. My husband has just been arrested. He's been taken away by the police. My kids are there wondering what on earth is going to happen to us and what's going on here. What do I do?
And I think with the agencies participating in this project, and probably many others in the state, the first comment wouldn't be, you need to get out and go to shelter. It would be, what do you want to do? The whole idea is what can be the most survivor-driven, and by that I mean your choices. When we look at survivors of domestic violence, the level of control has often been so great that the idea of being able to encourage their own choices and options and to creatively think through what could be the safest, most immediate response to the situation. And maybe it is a reprieve someplace else. Maybe there does need to be, whether it is that community living shelter or whether there are other shelter options that would be a little bit more suitable for a family, especially when there are cultural specific dynamics within the family, or if there are teenage boys or several generations of family living under one household roof. So just exploring that initial piece. And for many women have said, I'd really like to stay here. My children are comfortable. I have a special needs child enrolled in this particular program. So going from there to what can happen to make this place safe, and how can we support you economically to maintain that home, whether it's rent, and many of our pilot projects have helped with mortgage payments. Sometimes it is just totally not feasible down the road for a woman to be able to maintain the expenses of that particular home. So the projects have been able to support her stay there for a period of time as she's looking for another place and move her from that original home to another home that might be safer and might be more affordable for her. So you say a period of time.
What kind of a period of time? Are we talking weeks? Are we talking months?
Yeah, weeks or months. Again, it would be according to both the financial ability of the program to pull that together for support for a person, as well as her own resources and what her choices are. And, sometimes the scenario you described, if someone just got arrested that night and chaos is ensuing, it might be a little difficult to think clearly to what is it I want to do next. And so that's why I mentioned a place of reprieve might be the place, might be best, or it might be right there where she is. And the advocate, instead of offering her the available options and suggesting what she does, would instead be saying, what do you want to do and how can we support you in that? And sorting through that in that way.
It sounds like the approach is a lot less paternalistic, if you will, than the concept of a shelter. And while I certainly understand, you know, that the idea of how it started with the shelter being around other people who are have similar experience and, you know, get support there, it sounds like the approach is a lot different with the Housing First project. Mm-hmm. It sounds like it's more dependent on the needs that the victim defines.
Right. And absolutely. We found that some survivors are really happy with maybe a $50 check in order to get certified for their particular profession so that they continue their employment and maintain their home. And other families have needed $2,000 to $3,000 worth of assistance. But that whole range is actually much more cost-effective than shelter, and again, often provides an environment that is better for the healing of the family. So we really focus on tailored services. What is it that that survivor needs and wants for herself and for her children? And then to really look at mobile advocacy. So instead of requesting that the survivor come into an office or come into a shelter, often advocates are out in the field meeting survivors where they identify it is safe and convenient for them to do so. So that's been another really different, unique thing with this particular project. So our rural programs say, well, for many of them, that's the only way we could get together with women because transportation in a rural community is not necessarily that easy. But just really looking at how do we meet people where they are, both figuratively and literally, in terms of that location that is safe and comfortable and a place where she doesn't have to take three buses to get to.
Yes, yeah. To me, I would think, you know, staying in the same school for the kids would be crucial if that's possible at all.
Absolutely.
You know,
and
kids
some
have
of the
chaos
the,
to live through without having to change schools on top of it all, you know.
And some of the flexible funding has been used to help a survivor either secure a car or learn how to drive or get car insurance to better help her access education and employment. Sometimes it's helped with the needs of the children so that they can heal. We've heard from so many survivors that their own stability is dependent upon the health and well-being of their kids. And knowing that their children can access maybe a YMCA or be able to have the different sorts of school supplies or school camps that other kids have. Because we've learned that survivors will often have to make a choice between paying for rent or maybe paying for a program for their children. And so this project is trying to eliminate tough choices like that, so that if there's something critical for the child's safety, health, well-being, either the project can pick up that cost or could pick up the rental cost that a survivor might choose not to do or to be late on in order to provide for her kids. So the beauty and the flexibility of both this money and the type of service advocacy available has just gotten a great response from not just survivors but advocates, saying that it is so much more enjoyable to really focus on domestic violence advocacy and not policing a shelter. And to be able to say, yes, we can do that, instead of, well, no, that's not an eligible expense or activity. So,
so
it's been fun for a lot of folks.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about what the shelter is like, the shelter experience, because certainly there's still a lot of shelters out there, and it sounds like your pilot project is really, really doing some good, but the reality is still probably a shelter experience for a lot of women. So what does that mean for a woman who goes to a shelter with her kids?
Well, there are several different models of shelter, and I think the one that we think of the most often and is the most common is that community living shelter. And generally, a woman with her children will enter that shelter and certainly be welcomed warmly. I know that my colleagues and many advocates in the shelter system are loving and absolutely committed to the safety and well-being of every family that comes to them. But generally, as someone is arriving, they will get a bedroom. Sometimes they have to share the bedroom with another family or individual. Sometimes they need to share bathrooms. The kitchens are most likely shared. So there's that time of course, the opportunity to get to know other people and to talk about their experiences with others who have many similar experiences. And sometimes it can be a little bit challenging when you're worried about your personal privacy and things being with strangers and not necessarily knowing who they are and how their children will act around your children. So shelter can be very chaotic. It can also be very loving and warm. And in general, so that people can live together, there tend to be some very basic rules to help with the common respect that people should have for one another, as well as for the cleanliness of the shelter. So it's...
So you have to deal with deciding chores, that kind of thing?
Right. And I know many programs are trying to get away from some of that, but generally the common chores, it's not only just keep your own room clean and orderly, but also the common chores related to the shared living spaces, especially the kitchen, trying to figure out child care, sometimes that's shared among residents. Other programs try to make sure an advocate or a child care person is available to help support survivors. So it varies, but that's one model. There are also a number of programs that have individual housing units. So instead of trying to share accommodations, survivors and their families will get an individual unit. There are some programs that do that in scattered sites in a complex. Others have their own apartment building and will do that within that building. Others have fourplexes or duplexes that they will use. So it really
varies. I've also heard of shelters providing vouchers for hotel space. Is that still being done at this point?
It's definitely being done, and what we, of course, encourage is that a voucher isn't just given and the family forgotten about or not provided with services, but that whenever someone does go into a hotel, usually because the shelter is full or because that is the only immediate resource available, we really hope that there is advocacy available to that family just as if they were in a shelter or an apartment building.
No. So when you say advocacy, you've been using that term a lot, and just so that in case somebody
jargon.
Doesn't know what that is, would you explain an advocate job?
An advocate's job is there to basically provide support, to listen, to kind of help with that safety planning process, to offer resources, and to kind of provide the information related to those resources so that a survivor might be able to make informed choices. So it's another term might be navigator. How do you navigate a system? How do you think of all of the different things you might need to in terms of safety and in terms of even driving to work? And sometimes that advocate is the person who might be speaking for or being alongside of that survivor in one of the many systems that they might need to negotiate, whether it is supporting someone through the legal system as they look for attorneys or secure a protection order. Sometimes it is the process of the welfare system or the Children's Protective Services system. So what can a survivor turn to and get from an advocate depends, again, on her, and the advocate's role is to be versatile and to, again, take the direction of what the survivor wants and needs and provide the resources, informed options, and outcomes that someone might choose from. Some of the best work a survivor might be doing with an advocate is thinking about the relationship. There are so many situations now where advocates, instead of saying you can't be in our program if you return to your abusive partner, will now support a survivor.
They really say that?
There have been many programs that have said that.
And
that has changed and evolved over the years to the point now where programs are saying, we understand your potential need for contact, whether it's related to kids or whether there might be other things that need to happen within a family unit. So we understand the contact, we understand the ambivalence, understand that sense of, well, gee, I need to see that person, my partner, him or her again. So instead of discouraging that contact or even forbidding it, basically saying we can be there to help you through that, because otherwise survivors will do it. And it's much preferable for an advocate to know that and to be able to be that, again, that supportive presence of, this is how you can be safe, keep in touch, we're there for you. Your choices are your choices, and we support your choices.
I've read a study, though, that sometimes advocates, I'm just talking in general, sometimes advocates have strong feelings if the woman does not leave right now. The
mm-hmm.
study that I read indicated that some of the advocates felt like, well, this person's not listening to us, so what good is it? And they have kind of a problem with that. Is that something that advocates have training for?
All of our programs across the country, and certainly in Washington State, do have required training. And part of the advocacy training does include choices, does include the options piece, does include the whole survivor-centered focus, so that an advocate is never going to say, well, if you don't choose to leave, I can't work with you, or I feel strongly about it. So there is that sense of support for advocates in their training and in their peer work with one another to realize that survivors will choose to return. You know, we know the average, the 7 to 9 times leaving.
Which is about the same time amount of tries it takes to quit smoking.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's that change. I mean, it's a huge change. It's a huge decision to make, and it takes a long time. And generally, by the time a survivor ends up in our system, our domestic violence or shelter system, she's already tried living a few times or tried separating and done so with family or friends or maybe her own independent attempt. So usually when she comes to us, it's not the first time that she's been attempting this sort of analysis of the relationship and of her safety needs. So we try and work with advocates to help them to let go of choices a survivor makes that they might think are not the safest or the best for her. And I realize that some of the most heartbreaking cases are when there are children and when there are the concerns of maybe not direct child abuse from that abusive parent, but just witnessing and being present for domestic violence is traumatizing for children and certainly impacts them for years to come without appropriate support and intervention and a place to heal. So all of this is what an advocate is thinking about when a survivor chooses to return or to try to patch up the relationship. So there's definitely the training and support and encouragement for advocates to, again, let go of the choices a survivor makes. And unless, of course, the children are directly being abused, neglected, or if it's if it necessitates a CPS report, that's another thing. But generally, it takes a while. And advocates, as heartbreaking as it may be at times, have to learn how to go with that and have to take care of themselves in their own way and their own form of self-care that they can do that and still be fresh and ready for that same survivor if she calls back the following year.
Okay, let me throw out our phone number again because I'm finding this discussion fascinating. I really like the changes that I'm hearing about, Linda. Our phone number is 646-378-0430. That's 646-378-0430. Just give us a call and let us hear your story and your experiences with shelters or with the Housing First program if you've been lucky enough to take advantage of that. So what I'm seeing, Linda, is that there's a big trend in providing assistance for domestic violence victims. We have gone in the last 30 years, would you say 35 years, this has been the real length of this movement where it's really been about 35 years, isn't it?
Early to mid-70s, it's getting up there, yeah.
Yeah, so we started out with focus on just getting her out of there and not worrying about the other stuff, just getting her out and someplace safe. And that was the best thing that people could think of at the time, was a shelter. And it's a good idea, it's a good concept, but it doesn't always work for everyone. And so now it sounds like the Housing First thing is not just housing, that it's the whole idea that the victim gets to make choices here, that power that's been ripped away from her is something that she can get back with a little facilitation. Is that right?
It is to a degree. The whole choice actually precedes Housing First and has been something that we've been working on for probably the last 5 to 10 years in terms of being more responsive to the needs of survivors. And Housing First, actually, as we in the domestic violence field have taken it from the housing homeless world, we are wrapping those survivor choices or client-driven choices, whatever jargon you might want to use for that, and saying that this is the most effective way that Housing First operates, really, is when we listen to the choices and the needs and the desires of the person who is either leaving an abusive relationship or struggling with homelessness, is when they get to pick, when they have more autonomy, because that way they're bought into what the final solution is. We all appreciate having our own choices, and when it's a choice that we make, we tend to own it a little bit more and tend to work on the components that lead to our stability in that particular choice. So it's actually an opportunity for the domestic violence world to transform the housing homeless system a little bit too, as we realize how many survivors and their children are in that system and what can we do that is both driven by their choices, their own unique need for individualized services, and just their own progression to heal from the trauma.
So how many people has Housing First served in this state, in Washington State?
The first
during its 4-year history, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The first group of four cohort agencies served 236 households. And the second cohort of nine agencies as of March 13th, and this is September 11th through March 13th, served 400 households. So, yeah, 636 households as of March 13th.
Wow.
And that's just for this particular project, yeah.
Yeah, and how many people administer this? It's something that's done through the first contact, or how? What's the process? If I contact a domestic violence agency, a service agency, what do I do next if I want to stay in my own home?
Generally, just talk about staying in your own home. And if it is an organization that has flexible money in this way, you would probably be put in touch with eventually that advocate who does that particular project and disperses that fund. There are organizations now, and LifeWire in East King County is one of them, that has been a part of Cohort 1. They have integrated this particular approach into their regular services. So anybody on the line would be able to support and facilitate that process. So a crisis line advocate would send any initial request to any one of several advocates that could provide, whether it's the legal support and response, the community services, or the housing stability services. They've integrated it in a way so that you're not going from advocate to advocate to advocate, but that there is a holistic response to the needs that someone might have. So from that first call, processing through, eventually going to the next advocate, and that advocate would be available to meet with you where it's convenient. There would be the option to come into the office or the option to meet in a safe, convenient place for you in the community and to talk about the different needs, whether those are legal, whether those are housing, whether those are related to children's services. So hopefully making it smoother. And, of course, with our little agencies, our little rural agencies where staffing is so small anyway, that's pretty much always been the case. But the advocates who have traditionally worked with survivors coming in now have the additional option of housing stability. What would help you be stable in housing? Is that where you are now? Could that be made safer for you? Could we help with it being economically feasible? Or is it just so out of your range or so dangerous that we need to think about other options for you for housing?
No. Another article that I ran across this week, Linda, was one that said that, of course, everyone who hears about domestic violence, their first comment is, well, why doesn't she just leave? And I think our discussion about housing and how complicated that is probably one of the best answers that there is to that question. The other response, of course, I have to that question is, she usually does, maybe not on your timetable, but, you know, on hers.
Yeah.
And the article was basically, there have been so many funding cuts that, you know, why doesn't she just leave becomes even more complicated, because where's she going to go? Have you
Absolutely.
Seen funding cuts affect the people that you're working with? And if so, how are you going to compensate for that to keep the program going?
I think it's a matter of how programs are structured. Certainly there is the threat of cuts here in Washington State. We've been very, very fortunate to date in terms of state funding. Federal funds have hung in there. Those sequestering certainly has had a little bit of an impact with some of our shelter money. The state of Iowa just recently went through a complete restructure of their services, which included closing many shelters. And the idea was to move more to this concept of mobile advocacy and providing more services for a greater number of people, because that's one of the challenges with a facility-based shelter, is that it does take a lot of resources and is only able to serve a very small number of people. So being able to shift the resources and focus away from that as kind of the main option or only option, and looking more at providing funding for advocates to do more holistic work in the field, and to provide a couple of months' worth of rental assistance, which would equate to a couple of days in an emergency shelter for a family. So the idea of
maintaining a structure, of maintaining a staff, all of that actually is much more expensive than just having a mobile advocate out there and having this kind of a program, like the Housing First program, operating. Is that what you're saying, kind of?
Exactly. And in the state of Iowa, when the state, both the state funders and the state coalition work together at a solution that is similar to this project, that promised to serve many, many more, both the survivors of sexual assault as well as domestic violence, their state legislature was so impressed with the plan and the results they were seeing so far that they actually tripled their funding. So I think being more thoughtful about how we structure our services and how we can reach more people and provide more suitable options versus kind of thinking that so many domestic violence survivors have to come to that emergency community living shelter versus doing something that is a little bit more community-based, a little bit more holistic, and certainly more directed by the survivors and what they need to do.
Well, it sounds like it's
a
much more individualized approach.
Absolutely. Yeah,
which sounds good to me. You mentioned that the state was so happy with the results of the mobile advocates and whatever, and the services that they were providing. How is that measured? Just number of people served, or is there another kind of measurement for comparing shelter services versus the mobile advocates and Housing First type of program?
What they used in Iowa were number of people served, and they actually had a couple of their programs before this major shift that we're doing rapid rehousing, Housing First, for survivors of domestic violence. So they were able to look at the increased numbers that those programs were able to do in comparison to what they had done previously under a fixed emergency shelter structure, as well as comparing that with other programs in the state that still focused on community living shelter. And I don't have those numbers under my nose, but I know that it was pretty impressive in terms of what was available then to serve more people and more diverse people. I haven't talked a lot about just the diversity involved in being able to tailor services to culturally specific communities. And several of our projects are, three are on reservations, three tribal programs. There is another one that is specifically targeted for refugees and immigrants, and another one that's targeted for farm workers. So being able to think creatively with different communities, and these communities are not ones that traditionally will go to shelter. So trying to think of what can be the most supportive, stabilizing approach for all of them.
You said, Linda, that one of the things you guys are working on right now in the Housing First program is sustainability. Your grant runs out in another year. What kinds of ways are you looking at to provide, to make sure that this program continues?
Well, a lot of it, of course, is messaging. With each one of our cohort agencies, we're doing a video to help them support that messaging. You know, so many of our communities have invested in the poor victim and the battered women's shelter, and it's nice to do the adopt-a-room and see visibly where your donations might be going if you can. But we're trying to shift the messaging a little bit for community stakeholders to say, you know, what is it like to invest in the stability of a household? What could that household do once the head of household is back in the employment world and children are safe and stable in schooling and they can contribute back to the community, and the child is going to heal from that trauma and we can end the cycle of abuse with that child. So I think it's a huge messaging shift, and we're certainly supporting the organizations with doing that so that they can appeal to their current private donors as well as foundations. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has been doing everything that they possibly can to publicize this project and the results of the project to their colleagues in the philanthropy world. And finally, public funders. That funding is just a little bit more restrictive, but the idea that some pots of money, such as for emergency DV shelter, could be used more flexibly than supporting a facility project is out there. It's possible programs are doing it. So we're thinking about funding shifts. We're thinking about messaging changes and how that messaging support can happen from the coalition. And looking to the Gates Foundation to continue to provide a leadership role with the people with which they influence, whom they influence.
Mm-hmm. And so are you feeling positive about that?
Very.
Do you feel like is a program that's going to continue?
I believe it will. In one way or another, whether it is at the coalition level as we continue to work with our member agencies across the state, and certainly each one of these agencies are trying to figure out their own structuring level, funding structure level to continue it. LifeWire has been a wonderful example in East King County where that particular director basically wrote this project and the needs of this project into their budget and is working with the board and community to make sure that it is funded adequately. So there's a lot
and
of hope.
Is this a difficult time to go after extra funding for a program like this, or do most donors understand the importance here?
I believe that donors understand the importance. And I think as we look at Iowa as an example, that donors and taxpayers, the same group of people in many ways, they want to make sure that the money that is invested is well used and that there is an outcome that they can see really improves the health of the community, improves just the well-being of families who have been traumatized. I think it's the idea that resources are being used prudently. And showing that makes a huge difference. And I've watched light bulbs go off when you think of providing an option that any one of us would prefer if we needed help, if tragedy hit, and saying, well, of course, why wouldn't that family want something that supported their autonomy and independence and stability versus going off and having to hide somewhere with a group of other people. And I don't want to diminish the importance that the shelter movement has had for us over the years and the thousands of lives that it has saved. And I think it's important to encourage that we move on and figure out new ways.
And this sounds like a wonderful way to me, Linda. I was so encouraged when I saw this program and read about it. And at what point will you have a final evaluation? I mean, you still have a year to go on the program. Do you think that there will be a final evaluation that you can will share with the public?
Part of our funding was for an evaluator, and we have got the draft of the first 3-year pilot of our 4 cohort agencies. So I am sifting through that draft right now. We have an evaluation of the first year for our second cohort.
Wow.
But as we continue, we will be putting evaluations on our webpage, which is
okay.
wscadv.org.
Linda. Thank you so very much for that. I've had a really great time, and I've learned a lot today. And I want to thank you for joining me. We usually end our show with a quote, and today I have a quote from Gaston Bachelard. I have no idea who that is. But his quote is, "I should say the house shelters daydreaming. The house protects the dreamer, and the house allows one to dream in peace." Thank you for joining us this week on Three Women, Three Ways. Join us next week. And thank you again, Linda Olson.
Thank you.